someone who embodies and who has kept alive the legacy of your grandfather. It's an honor to have you here with us this morning. It's also wonderful to be able to engage you in conversation on Martin Luther King Jr. weekend. As many know, the civil rights movement, when it burst onto the national scene, King named your grandfather as the guiding light of their approach to social change. I am intrigued and interested in the connections and the relationships, relations that can be drawn between King and your grandfather. We know that when King later went to visit India, he said he went not as a tourist, but as a pilgrim. Your grandfather undoubtedly had a profound impact on him. And so I'm wondering how you think of King in relationship to your grandfather. What connections or comparisons do you draw beyond the general similarity of their being nonviolent leaders of social movements?
Well, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to be here this morning to share with all of you my understanding of my grandfather's philosophy and what he lived for and what he died for. And this being Martin Luther King's anniversary, it's very appropriate that we link the two and find out what did they both stand for. Martin Luther King did acknowledge the fact that he was inspired by my grandfather's writings, and he learned a lot from it. He got the methods of how to fight for justice through nonviolence. And when he launched his campaign first in Montgomery, Alabama, and it was very successful with the bus boycott, the government of India invited him to come to India and meet with the people who had lived and worked with grandfather. Because by then, my grandfather had already been assassinated, so he couldn't meet him directly. But they said, you can come here and meet with people who had worked with him and learn from them. And so Dr. King and his family and many other civil rights leaders came as a group, as guests of the government of India. And they were allowed to go all over the country and meet important people and have discussions with them. And they, being the guests of the government, they were staying at the best hotels in every town. And then they came to the city of Mumbai. And in Mumbai, we have the best hotel in the world called the Taj Mahal, where the room rates run from $1,000 a night upwards. And they were all staying in the Taj Mahal there. So Dr. King goes there and he checks in and leaves his bags, and then the whole group went out on a tour of the city. And in the city we have a house which my grandfather used whenever he came to Mumbai, and that was between 1915 and 1932. So that house has now been turned into a museum. And there are library books and museum and photographs and all kinds of things there. And so the group came to that museum. And upstairs in the museum is the room which my grandfather occupied. And it was furnished, and it still is furnished, the way it used to be. And that is no furniture at all. It's a bare room. In one corner of the room is a mattress with a white sheet over it. That is where he slept, and that is where he sat and worked. There's a little stool that he used as a desk. There is a spinning wheel that he spun cotton with. And that's about it. There's nothing else in that room. So the museum is, they've kind of glass-walled that room so that nobody can go inside. They just have to look inside the room from the outside. And when Dr. King and his group came there and they saw the room, Dr. King expressed the desire to go and sit inside and meditate. And being a government guest and an honored guest, the director obliged and opened the door for him, but she said, "It's only you, not the whole group. Only you can go in and sit." So he said, "Fine." And he dismissed the group and went inside and sat there. And so the director went around doing her work. And then soon it was time to close. And Dr. King was showing no signs of coming out of the place. So finally she went up to ask him, said, "When are you leaving? Because we have to close up and go home." And he said, "I'm not leaving." And she was aghast. And she said, "What do you mean you're not leaving?" He said, "I'm going to spend the night here. I'm not ready to leave." She said, "We don't have any facilities for you. How can you spend the night in the museum? Besides, you have your room at the Taj Mahal." He said, "No, if Gandhi could sleep on the floor, I'm going to sleep on the floor. And if he could work there, I'll work there. I'm going to be here all night, so let's not argue with it. You lock up and go, and just leave me here." And so she locked up and went. And Dr. Martin Luther King sat in that room till 10 o'clock the next morning. And only then he came out from there and announced that, "Now I feel spiritually strong enough to go back and lead my people in the civil rights struggle."
Well, thank you for that wonderful story. It strikes me that one of the similarities between King and your grandfather was the way in which they engaged other faiths and people of other religions. Just in terms of King's view of your grandfather, as early as his seminary days in school, for a Christian theology class, he presented a paper in which he named your grandfather as one among the people who greatly manifest the workings of the Spirit of God. And
yeah, I think he was among the first people in recent times to launch an interfaith campaign. He believed that religion and worship it's the same. We have made divisions and created different people there, but there is only one God and there's only one way of worshiping. And he used to always say, and this is a beautiful quotation of his that I often use in my own writing. He said, "A friendly study of all the scriptures is the sacred duty of every individual." And he emphasized the word friendly. Well, we have made critical studies of scriptures all the time, but nobody has really made a friendly study. And he made that friendly study, and he found that none of the scriptures were perfect, none of them had the whole truth. All of them had a little bit of the truth. And he said that by reading all the different scriptures, he was able to extract that little bit of truth and create a better image of what spirituality and what God really means. But what we are doing instead is that we are hanging on to that little bit of truth there, and so we have a very distorted picture of God and very distorted message, understanding of the message. And so we perform rituals without really meaning and incorporating that in his life. He incorporated all the religions in his life. So his daily prayer services every morning and evening were prayers from Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, all of these different religious prayers. He incorporated that, and we would all sit together outside in the open so that anybody who wanted to come and join the prayers would join, and sometimes there were thousands of people who would join the prayers. And there would be Hindus and Muslims and Buddhists and everybody sitting there, and we are all singing these different prayers. What he tried to do by this method of worship was to bring about an understanding between all the different religions, and through understanding, bringing about peace between differences. Today we have created a lot of competition between religions. Everybody claims that their religion is the best and their way to God is the best. But there is no best way to God. The best way to God is when we live the message that God intends us to live. He would say that prayer, worship is like climbing a mountain. Says we are all going up ultimately to the same peak. So why should it matter to anybody which side of the mountain we choose to climb up from? If we have that understanding that everybody has a right to go up in different ways, but we are ultimately going to the same place. So why the competition? Why not just accept everybody and live with everybody in peace through understanding?
I understand that as a child, some Christian missionaries had a very negative display that he witnessed, but he was able later through reading the Sermon on the Mount, which we read part of earlier, and then through his relationship with Tolstoy, came to a very different place. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, he writes in his biography that when he was a little child and he was going to school, walking to school every day, he would find Christian priests standing on street corners denouncing Hinduism and talking about how good Christianity is and inducing people to convert into Christianity. And it kind of turned him off. He says he was so disgusted with this. So how can you put down somebody and claim to be superior than others? But he was too young then to go into the philosophy of it. But it did hurt him a lot. And then when he grew up, he realized that we need to learn about each other and what is the truth. Because for a long time he believed that God is truth. And then he turned the phrase around and he said, no, truth is God. So if we really seek the truth, if we are determined to find the truth in life, then we are working towards finding God. But when we ultimately find truth, what is our life meant to be? Why are we here on earth? These are questions that sometimes we grapple with and sometimes we just ignore and continue to live. And he said that life is not about going around in circles from birth to death. Life is about becoming better human beings. And we have to make that conscious effort every day that we are going to be better today than we were yesterday. And when we make that conscious effort, then we raise ourselves up and become better human beings, more conscious of people around us, be conscious of people's pain and agony and are willing to help with in whatever way we can. And if all of us can do little things to help people in difficulties, we can make a big difference there. You know, today we have so much of disparities and economic disparities and all kinds of disparities. But we can shut it off and not be bothered about it, because we live in a country where we have everything we need. I had a very interesting experience. You know, I take a Gandhi legacy tour every year to India, and we go to many of these Gandhi spots where he lived, and many programs that are inspired by Gandhi, Gandhi's philosophy, and young people are doing some wonderful work for the poor people. And this tour is modest. We travel by trains and buses and so on, and we go out into the villages. For the first few years, we had these young women from Wellesley College who had joined the tour, and they would come. And first part of the tour was going into the villages, dusty, traveling by buses, and in the villages, we had decent hotels, but old-fashioned hotels. There were no showers. We had to fill up buckets and have a bath with that. And these women had never had that. They had never done that in their life. So they didn't know what you use the bucket for. And so they were, by the fourth or fifth day, they were a little bit antsy, and they were all complaining among themselves about, when are they going to be able to wash their hair and have a decent bath and sleep in a proper bed and all that. And on the fifth day, when we went to the city of Ahmedabad, fortunately our travel agent was able to get us reservations in a brand new 5-star hotel that had just opened. So as a promotion, they had given us rooms there at half the rates. So we go in there, and we're waiting in the lobby for our room assignment. These women were so ecstatic. They're finally seeing the things that they are used to seeing, all the luxury and the wonderful things, and they're excited about how they were going to sleep in a proper bed and wash their hair and all that. And the moment they got their room keys, they just rushed to their rooms. Half an hour later, they come back looking for me and says, "Mr. Gandhi, we've got to move from here." I said, "What happened? You were so excited half an hour ago. Why the change?" And they said, "Well, we went up to the room and we looked out of the window, and we see all the poor people in shanties living right below the window there. And we feel guilty that if they are living like that and we are living in all this luxury." So I said, "Well, I'm glad that you're feeling guilty. But this is going to be a lesson for you. And we are going to stay in this hotel for the next 3 days. And every day you're going to look out of that window and see how the other half of the world lives. In the US, we can block it out. We don't need to look out of the window. So we can just assume that there is no poverty and enjoy all the luxuries there. But here you're going to see this poverty every day. And then I hope you'll learn a lesson and realize what your mission in life is. That if we want peace, we have to do something to help those poor people attain a better standard of living."
Well, thank you. I think that segues nicely to my next question for you. Just before the Montgomery bus boycott, King read an essay written by a former Pennsylvania Senator, Harris Wolford, about your grandfather. And what Wolford said in that essay was that your grandfather sought to live out the Sermon on the Mount. And so I'm wondering what you think today, how we can live out the legacy of King and your grandfather, or to put it in the words of the Sermon on the Mount, how can we be blessed peacemakers today?
Well, I think, it's very important for us to, as I said earlier, that we read scriptures, we read prayers every day, and most of the times we just mouth them, and then we go out and get busy with our own things, and we forget about all the message of the scriptures there. What Grandfather said is that we can't forget about them. We have to incorporate them and we have to live them. And he was very impressed by the Sermon on the Mount, so much that some Christian friends of his, E. Stanley Jones and others, who heard that he was very impressed by the Sermon on the Mount, they said, "Why don't you become a Christian if you are so impressed by the Sermon on the Mount?" And Grandfather says, the day you can convince me that all Christians live according to the Sermon on the Mount, I will become a Christian." And although he said this in terms of the Christians and Sermon on the Mount, but it's, the truth is that none of us in any religion live what we are required to do. And basically what his philosophy, and this is what troubles me a lot today, because when we talk about Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolence or Martin Luther King's philosophy of nonviolence, we only talk about it as a conflict resolution program, that they used it to get independence for India and for civil rights in this country, and so it's just another method of conflict resolution. And scholars have written about it in that format. And I think that it's not just conflict resolution, it's way of life. If we don't incorporate the philosophy of nonviolence in our life, we can't really practice nonviolence. You know, it's not like an electric switch that you can put on and off and become nonviolent one moment and violent the next moment. You have to make a decision. You want to be nonviolent or violent? A lot of people tell me that nonviolence is negative because it's the opposite of violence then. And what I've done is I've removed the hyphen in the word nonviolence. I've made it one word. I said it stands on its own. It doesn't need a hyphen there. And so I'm the only person in the world, I think, who uses that word as one word and not with the hyphen. But the thing there is to make people realize that it's not the opposite of violence. It stands on its own. It's a very positive philosophy, because to practice nonviolence, we have to become better human beings. We have to allow love and respect and compassion and understanding and all of these positive attributes and positive feelings to supersede and control our lives. Today, just the opposite is happening. Because we have created a whole culture of violence, a culture that has seeped into every aspect of our lives. Our sports is violence, our entertainment is violent, our language is violent, everything, relationships are violent, everything is violent. Religion has become violent. And that means that it brings out the worst in us. We are always suspicious of everybody, we hate everybody, we discriminate against people. We have all of these negative things controlling our lives and our emotions. And we've got to get rid of those negativities and be positive. Life is short and we need to do something to make it pleasant, not live in hate and prejudice and discrimination and fighting and killing each other.
Well, thank you very much. Let's give a round of applause again for...